Compassion Plans, Episode 5. Marketing is compassion.
This is John Lee Dumas of Entrepreneur on Fire, and you're listening to Compassion Plans with Ben Lee Davis. Let's make the world better together.
The world we live in is far from perfect. How can I effectively make a difference? This is Compassion Plans, a weekly interview to help you make the world a better place with your host, Ben Lee Davis.
That was Tad Hargraves from Marketing for Hippies, speaking in a language from my ancestral home of Scotland called Gaelic. What did you say, Tad?
Welcome, everybody, to Compassion Plans. Come inside.
Tad, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Tad, I liked starting off the discussion talking about compassion, which some people say is reducing someone else's pain. What pain are you passionate about reducing?
So with the Marketing for Hippies business, it really started with seeing how, for so many of my friends and so many of the clients I've ended up working with, marketing doesn't feel good. And, you know, they've gone to maybe a massage school or life coaching school or learned permaculture, and what they didn't learn was the business side. And so there's this tear inside of them between, I need to sustain myself, I need to eat, I need to make money, which means I need to market, but marketing doesn't feel good. And so now I need to do this thing that doesn't feel good in order to sustain myself. And so some people just completely collapse and give up. They don't end up making their business work because it just feels so terrible to market. Or they do it and then they're doing marketing things that don't feel good for them or for the person receiving it. And it's just this really painful situation for so many people I've come across.
Yeah, especially in the people you work with, they're trying to do something that is good. They're specifically trying to not take paths that are bad. So it's important for them that how they express that out to the world also kind of has that same outlook.
Yeah, it's painful to feel like the ends that you're trying to serve are good, but the means are terrible. It's a hard inconsistency to live with for a long time.
Since your title is Marketing for Hippies, would you give me how you define hippie?
I define that pretty broadly, with all due deference to the true hippies of the 60s. But, you know, a lot of my clients are massage therapists. They're the life coaches. They run a permaculture business. They're into holistic things, local food, farmers markets. They want to support local as much as possible, mistrustful of the man, into sustainability, resilience, all those types of things. So to me, it's people who sort of fit that milieu, who are maybe a little counterculture, you know, maybe radical, definitely progressive.
When you're helping them get their marketing, get the word out, how do you help all these people?
I mostly do sort of coaching and training, so I'm not like a boutique that they hire to get the word out. But there's kind of three things that I focus on with them. The first is this idea of the platform, of helping them clarify just what do they want to be known for. And for most entrepreneurs, that's very unclear. It's very fuzzy. You know, you'll say, what do you do? And it's like, oh, I'm a massage therapist. But it's just like, oh, so are so many people. Or they say something confusing like, I do this unique combination of Reiki, Shiatsu, Traeger, and the work that reconnects, you know? And it's like, right, I don't know what those words mean. So helping people just get clear on what do they want to be known for and sort of hone in on that as the first step. And then the second step is, I call it the paths. And it's just helping people try to find ways to make it easy for the people who are looking for you to find you. Because I think there's the thought that, oh, I need to go out searching for clients. And what we forget is that our ideal clients are actually already searching for us. You know, they're looking for solutions to their problems. And we often just make it very hard for them to find us. So there's a lot of thinking about how do we make it easier for them to come across us, if not inevitable. And then the third piece is this idea of the container and being ready to receive them when they show up. Are we ready? Like, do we have a website that really is compelling and clear and safe? And is there an email list that they can get on? Is there are there ways that they can check us out safely? And then once they have, are there sort of multiple levels of what we're offering? And is our business, and not just safe to approach, but sustainable for us financially? Is there a good business model behind it? So that's kind of the approach that I take generally.
I imagine it's got to be a bit challenging since many of them, I imagine, would be in the mode of fighting the man, but you kind of have to do a little bit of that business world in order to get everything straight. And being able to separate those two successfully might be a bit of a dichotomy for them.
Yeah, and I mean, it's still a dichotomy for me. You know, my value system increasingly leans towards a more indigenous kind of lifestyle, very close to the land, small community. And yet here we are in this big, epic, megacorp nation state system. And I just think for a lot of us, there is this, that's the bigger pain that we live with too, is that most of us, you know, if we could spend all of our money and make all of our money in the kind of conscious green economy, we'd want to.
Yeah.
if I could get all my power from like solar and geothermal and spend all my money at the organic grocery store and all my clothes are locally made, you know, and all my furniture is locally, all that, we'd love to do that. But most of us just can't afford that. And so we'd spend some money there. But, you know, it's like if you look at coffee right now, I think it's like 2% of the coffee grown in the world is fair trade, U.S. farmland, maybe 2% is organic, the rest is conventional. And so just I think as a world, we're in this moment of transitioning from this kind of more suicide economy that's killing itself to this more conscious green economy. It's a very big transition. And a lot of us we're all in the middle of that in some way. There are a lot of people who don't even agree with the idea of money. And yet we live in a culture where money is just makes everything a lot more convenient. And yeah, so I think we're all struggling. Like, how do I embody my values in a system that is so fundamentally misaligned with my values?
Yeah, my wife and I are starting to shop more organic and think about where our food's coming from and everything. So, but it is, at this point, a challenge. It'd be nice if there was a time where it was more the default way of living.
Totally.
Now, you mentioned that you spent a lot of time doing nonprofit and activist work, and then you went into marketing. And it seems like there's a time in your bio where you talk about the regret of some of your past marketing tactics. Can you share any stories about that?
So, yeah, I was working for a leadership development franchise. A lot of the marketing stuff was actually kind of interesting. And a lot of the sales stuff was very pushy, mm-hmm. Very aggressive, very much motivated on getting the sale. Like, that was the whole goal of it.
Right.
When you sat down with somebody, that was your goal, to get the sale. I just remember, like, I worked so hard, too. I, like, listened to all the tapes. I was in the office longer than anybody. I called so many people. It was a lot of cold calling. And I just remember, at the end of the days, going home and feeling gross. Because people on the phone would be like, aren't you listening to me? Like, I said no. And I'd keep trying to convince them. You know, and keep trying to use tactics like interrupting their pattern, like asking a total non-sequitur question, and then just going back for the close as if they weren't going to notice that. And like hyping up events to be more than they really were just to get them to say yes, because I was desperate to get a sale. Yeah, people called me out on it a lot, and it just felt so terrible. It was hard to sleep at night with it. I just thought that's what I had to do. That's what the tape said. That's what my employers were kind of encouraging. And so, and I imagine a lot of people are in that boat where there's something that doesn't feel right in your life, but that's the normal thing. Even though it feels unnatural, it's normal and everyone else is doing it. So I was like, well, it must be the right way.
Was there a specific time or story around when you broke free from that?
Well, the company kind of collapsed due to a bunch of factors. So it was interesting. There wasn't a moment where I was like, it took me like a decade to unpack it, I would say. But once I got out of it, you know, then I went down to Santa Cruz and I was working with this nonprofit, yesworld.org. They used to do summer camps all around North America. So I did that. And it was really wild because I'd grown up going to Waldorf School, which is this like hippie alternative school. And these camps that I was going to were very much Waldorf flavored. And so that felt really nourishing. I was like, oh my God, I remember this. Oh, innocence. That feels good. You know, going back to that. And at those events, there was a lot of critique being lifted up around capitalism and the system and all these hippies with drums talking about Babylon. And that was all new to me. I think slowly, because while I was working for this, doing the sales stuff, I'd very much drunk down like capitalism is great if you work the system. And it started to crack as I just was learning more about what was really going on in the world. And I would say the defining moment for me where things really clicked, because it had been getting chipped away in the back of my mind. And I wasn't doing a lot of sales stuff at the times. It was just, I don't know, a lot of thoughts were steeping there. And then I came across a guy, Ari Galper, and his website now is unlockthegame.com. But it was, at the time, it was called Reverse Selling. Something about the name really grabbed me. And he was the first person I'd ever come across who explained why selling felt so gross. And that it was all about when there's the agenda to get the sale instead of the agenda to get to the truth of is it a fit, it will feel gross. And so that our job in sales is not to push harder or be sneakier about how we're pushing people, but is actually to diffuse the pressure constantly.
Interesting.
Shift it from being a pitch to an actual human conversation where we're okay with them saying no.
Yeah, and you might even come to a point where you tell them no because you realize your product does not fit their needs.
Hugely. Which the irony is that can get you so much business because they leave being like, wow, that was very honest. And when their friend has something that actually is a fit for you, they send them.
Right.
But yeah, so I remember like hearing his stuff, and it was one of those moments I'm sure we've all had that, where, you know, you read something, it's like, oh my God, that's exactly what I need to hear right now. And so I just drank his stuff in a lot because I'd felt so tortured by it. I'd felt so confused. I'm like, well, but you need to convince people, don't you? And the tactics all seem so sexy too, because they're so stealthy. They're so, you know,
mm-hmm.
I was learning a lot of like NLP and how do you use embedded commands and anchoring and matching and mirroring and all this stuff. There's an allure to it because it makes you feel powerful. Like maybe I can influence and manipulate people. And so to have somebody kind of brush that all aside and be like, how about just a straightforward, honest approach where you don't need to hide anything, had me realize like, oh my God, all this hiding was so stressful.
And you host workshops?
So they've kind of shifted over the years. But yeah, I'll do like sometimes just an evening workshop or a day long or a weekend workshop where we just really dig into this question of how could marketing feel good. And most of my workshops I run, the live ones, I run on a pay what you can basis. So like for a day long workshop up until this point, it's been like a $25 deposit. And then they just pay me whatever they want to pay at the very end. And at the weekend, it's a $100 deposit and they pay with 3 checks post-dated spread out over the year for whatever amounts they want.
Were there any techniques you think you learned during that time in deep selling that are still effective is the wrong word?
Like still legit?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? This is one of the things I really got from over the years has sort of settled with me is it's less to do with the technique and it's a lot more to do with the intention behind it. You know, for example, with neurolinguistic programming, there's the idea of matching and mirroring. And basically, at a very simple level, if somebody is talking very quietly and you talk in a very similar tone, their nervous system is going to be soothed by that. Versus if you start talking really loud and brash, it's just going to jar them. But if somebody is talking loud and brash and you talk real quiet, it'll probably annoy them. Not consciously, but just at the nervous system level, it's like something doesn't feel like a fit. So that, I don't know, in some ways that feels like common sense. It's like, okay, yeah, just like meet people where they're at. There are certain things I think, like there's the idea of anchoring. So it's, you know, like Pavlov's dog, kind of, they associated the bell to the food. And that, you know, I saw somebody on stage and he was talking about some really terrible, disgusting things, but he kept touching himself on his chest while he was talking about those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I don't know if you want to be anchoring those sensations to you. You know, it's like you might want to like point somewhere else on the stage. But it is funny because like if you start doing that, you point to a certain part on the stage, if you went and sat there, the audience, like you see them get uncomfortable.
Yeah, they would have the feeling that you associated with it.
Yeah, it's like, oh God, he's sitting in that big pile of stuff that he put up. So, you know, there's just like common sense around that. And there's stuff in a therapeutic context. A lot of these tools actually become crucial because people have come saying, I want you to help me. I'm giving you permission to use these tools. But in a selling conversation, it's not like, hey man, I really want to buy this car, but I'm kind of scared. I'm wondering if you can do whatever it takes to get me to buy it.
Right.
You know, is a very different context. And so to me, as long as we use whatever tools we're using in service of getting to the truth faster, of is it a fit? To me, everything's open. Use whatever techniques and tools. I don't care if that's the intention. But if the intention is to get them to say yes, whether or not it's a fit, then it's unethical. Even if it seems like a real, not something you'd consider a big sales technique, like being nice to people. It's like, if you're being nice, okay, but are you being nice so they'll say yes? Now we're into manipulation.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Or even compassion, you know, nonviolent communication, active listening is wonderful. But you can also use that with the agenda of getting somebody to do something you want. And all of a sudden, it goes from this beautiful gift to this real subtle, sneaky manipulation.
You mentioned also that a lot of people kind of called you out on the phone when you were applying all these sales in that kind of old mentality.
Yeah.
Do you think, with all the studying and work under it, that you were successful for the most part and some people called you out? Or do you think that you never really got good at it because of this check that you felt?
No, it was terrible. It didn't work at all. That's the worst part, man. If it still worked, I might still be doing it. But I mean, there was a lot strategically that was probably wrong about the whole approach of cold calling people and like what we were offering them next. Like if we'd called them and like, hey, there's a free workshop, do you want to, you know, it might have worked better than me trying to sell them into a next level workshop. But no, it just didn't work. That was the thing. The whole approach of it was trying to get them to say yes instead of, yeah, like, hey, we've got this free workshop, and because you're at, you know, when this guy came live, we'd love to invite you to that. You're totally our guest, no pressure. I bet you we would have had a ton of people say yes. And while they're there, we could have built a relationship, you know, and invited them to come to other workshops, and a lot of them would have.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So a lot of the techniques that you're talking about now, which
yeah,
are kind of becoming popular, that with the attitude they had before, they wouldn't have even considered those tactics.
No.
Because if you're in that high sales technique, it's like, no, I'm not going to invite them to a free seminar.
Yeah.
I can get them to give the sale over the phone.
And it's funny, I find there's often this unconscious attitude, I haven't really said this before, but this feels true, but like that people feel like it has to be hard.
Right.
Like I've got to be using all these techniques and being super sneaky, otherwise I'm not being effective somehow. When in my experience, like the simpler and easier it is, the safer we make it for people to, you know, it's like so much of it is just figuring out the right kind of structure and flow and business model that works. You know, it's like, okay, what's the free thing that you could offer that everyone's really craving that would give them a taste of what you do?
Right.
And then what's the next thing that you could offer them? And just having that really well thought out, you know, people often think marketing is what makes me money, but it's really the business model and the structure that does or does not have you make money. And when a business is designed really well, when people are really clear about their niche, when they know what their role is, and they design their business well, it's like there's effort, but it's not a struggle.
Right. Yeah, it's work, but not pain. So I've been learning marketing to get this podcast to where people can see it. And one thing that I found interesting, and on some other past projects, and I want to see if you find the same thing, it's that when you're learning on how to express your business or how you're trying to help, it's almost like that experience of developing your marketing material is getting out of your own head and getting into the head of your customer. What words do they use to understand what you're doing for them?
Yeah.
So it's almost like to get at that real good marketing approach, you have to forget about yourself. The fastest way to get to it is to really have empathy for the person you're talking to.
Huge. That's the bottom line. It's, people go to marketingforhippies.com/empathy-in-marketing. I wrote an epic, huge post just about that. Yeah, it's so often missing. You know, there was one of my colleagues, Govert van Ginkel, in the Netherlands, it's his real name.
Wow.
I know. But he teaches nonviolent communication and that kind of stuff. And he was talking about a school where the principal saw that the teachers had terrible communication skills. But the challenge is you can't go to people with terrible communication skills and say, come to this communication skills workshop and learn how to be a less terrible communicator.
Right.
Like, they're not going to go to it. And so they did this genius judo move of saying they're going to be hosting a workshop on how to deal with difficult parents.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because that's what the teachers thought. They were like, yes, parents are difficult. That's not me. So it's a little sneaky, but it's also the empathy in it is, what is the teacher's experience?
Right.
Regardless of our diagnosis, which can often be very paternalistic and condescending for where people are at, what do they need? You know, the metaphor I use constantly in my work is this idea of island A and B. It's like our ideal clients, they're on island A, where they're very sad because they have some problem or some symptoms they don't like. They want to be on island B, where there's some result that they're craving. And our business or project is like a boat that can take them from one island to the other. What we do a lot in marketing is talking about the boat. People tend not to care that much about our boat. They care at a certain point, but not in the beginning. What they really care about is, can it get me to island B? Can it get me off island A? Mm-hmm. That's really the first order of business. To me, the empathy really is like, who is this person on island A and what is their experience and how would they say it? What are they craving? Because, you know, let's say you wanted to help people with migraines and your understanding of migraines was that it was primarily about dehydration. And you put an ad in a paper being like, are you dehydrated? It's not like people with migraines are going to be, wait a minute, maybe that's what my migraines are, you know?
Right.
And it seems so obvious. But yeah, it's like this putting ourselves in their shoes. And not one of my clients and colleagues is a sexologist in Toronto. Mm-hmm. She knows that what people need to have a really satisfying sex life is good communication, not having resentments, being present with each other,
right,
etc. But she knows that on island A, they're sitting there thinking, I need more techniques. And so instead of making them wrong, she has a workshop called Blow His Mind, another one, Blow Her Mind, you know, that are focused on that. For years, the thing that would frustrate me most is if a client came to me being like, I am desperate. I need money right now. I was expecting my coaching program to fill up. It did not fill up. I was banking on this whole workshop filling up. Nobody signed up. Or my partner has been supporting me for years financially, and now they're getting sick of it and they need me to make money
right
in the next 6 months. Like, what do I do? And that's always the worst place to be in for me as a coach. Like, because most of my stuff is a very slow marketing, think it through strategic approach. Mm-hmm. But what I realized, so I kind of started over the years that I'd talk to my colleagues and be like, what would you say if somebody's in a crisis? Like, you know, what are the best ideas? And I just started to collect it. And I'm just creating a product called The Meantime, meaning it's like, yes, you know you need to work on strategic stuff,
mm-hmm.
but in the meantime, what do you do to make money? And also the meantime, because it feels pretty vicious and mean. But it's interesting, because as I've been coming up with that product, now I'm like, I was like, oh, and I could do like a 30-day challenge where I help people get out of crisis using these techniques. And all of a sudden, I'm really excited to work with them. You know, it's like for somebody who's genuinely in that crisis of like, I need to make a lot of money fast, to sit them down and be like, you know, what you really need is to think about your strategy, and that's going to take time.
Yeah.
It's just like, screw you, you bastard, you know, right. There's just no empathy. And so it's like meeting people where they're at,
mm-hmm.
In our marketing language, so that when they read it, they're like, oh, this person gets me.
Yeah.
They know what it's like to be me, rather than just, hey, my boat's pretty awesome. My boat can help everybody. It's the best boat. Let me tell you, you want to know more about my boat? No, I'll tell you more anyways. It's like neither effective nor does it build any connection.
That's a great way for everyone who's in this world trying to either help people or just in general make the world better. You do have to find a way to share that with people in a way that they will understand it, not in the way that you want to say it.
Yeah.
Can you share some stories with us about the time that you were working with nonprofits and activists?
So that time was in the late 90s. I've been working in Santa Cruz, California, traveling around doing these summer camps for, you know, high school, college age youth around kind of environmental social justice issues. And then in 99, I started a project called Youth Jams with yesworld.org with that group. The goal of Youth Jams was to bring together leading young changemakers from around the world to learn from each other and cry on each other's shoulders and support each other and challenge each other. And I just saw that there were often these, a certain, I don't know, caliber or group of young people who were normally like leading everything in their community, speaking at all the conferences, and they didn't really have a chance to just hang out with each other, you know, and other people who were in a similar kind of boat. And so we did it in 99. It went really well. I did it again. 2000 went really well. And so now there's been, I think, like over 100 jams in so many countries around the world. Been going like 15 years. In that time, that was when a lot of the anti-globalization protests were happening. I went to Washington, D.C. for the April 11th IMF World Bank protests, and I was involved in some of the protests here in Edmonton, you know, hanging out with the anarchist crowd. Yeah, I did all those protests, and it was really empowering. It was really incredible. It felt amazing to be able to be doing something and protesting and seeing the media coverage. And I think for a lot of people involved in that, I know for me, so much of the empowering thing is just being a part of the process. Like sitting in a consensus circle and making decisions by consensus. You know, I remember going to Washington, D.C. and showing up at the convergence space where everyone was meeting. I'd been there 5 minutes and somebody giving me a tour. And all of a sudden, I was giving people tours because more people kept showing up. There was nobody to tour them. I said, well, I've been here just for a few minutes. Let me show you around. And it was like, oh, this feels so amazing. It's so decentralized and just this trust in people to, you know, take care of each other. And yeah, so it was really wonderful. And that time, along with the jams and everything, especially the jams, I was hearing just terrible stories of what was happening in people's countries. And you know, I never wanted to be a conspiracy theorist, but there was just this like, oh my God, that company did what in your country? Oh my God, but they didn't know. I mean, oh, they knew? Oh, okay. Oh, wait, you mean they found out and then they stopped? They didn't stop and they knew the whole time? And what, you know, like that conversation 100 times. So I feel like when I was younger, I had the sense of, yeah, the system works if you work the system. And then that kind of shifted into the system has some really deep problems that needs to be fixed and we can fix it. And then it became, this system is just, there's nothing good about it. Like this system is rotten to its core. And we just need to be building something else and dismantling this one as fast as possible. And I feel like that's really still where I am.
Do you have a large leaning between, or does it even matter to you, between evolution and revolution?
I think it's all needed is the thing. Joanna Macy has a great idea of like this time we're in. There's three types of work that are needed. There's the holding actions, where it's like the protests, the lockdowns, the sit-ins, writing letters to the editor, anything that's trying to slow down the juggernaut and hold it back and draw attention to it. Holding actions. And then there's building alternatives. Like, what are the other ways that we meet our needs? Everything from solar power, straw bale, permaculture, compact fluorescent light bulbs, all of that, you know, alternatives. And then third, shifting consciousness. So a lot of the decolonization work, healing work, nonviolent communication, etc. And her point was that we need all three of those. If we try to make the changes and remove any one of them, it all falls apart. And yet, people often have this sense of monopoly. You know, I was at this thing called the Spitfire Tour where they had celebrities paired up with activists and they're touring colleges in the States. And it was Woody Harrelson there with some other folks. And as one person stood up, it's like, hey, Woody, when are you going to get out on the street and do the real work with the people? And it was like, he's here. right now.
Yeah.
The sense that that's the real work, protesting.
Right.
Rallies, that's real, and everything else is somehow less real. And then people in permaculture can also be like, yeah, have your poorly organized anarchist protest where you forget your megaphone yet again. We're actually growing real food. This is the real work. You know, and then the people doing healing work are like, well, that's really wonderful. But, you know, these organizations you're building, if you build it from the same consciousness and you don't heal your heart, you're just going to recreate the system, you know. So this is the real work in our hearts. And it's all real is the thing. It's all so vital. And what's needed is, in my mind, two things. One is that people go to the work that they're drawn towards naturally and do the most radical version of that possible that they can do. And number two, that we all work together better. Because it's those three things, when put together, are just an order of magnitude more effective than when they're done separately. And so often they are done separately. So often people who are doing this alternatives kind of work try to disavow themselves from the radical activists. There's this notion of the Overton window, where it's like people in politics can't be too radical in either direction, you know, left or right. And there's a certain window called the Overton window that they can work within. And if somebody comes up with a policy that's outside of that, it's very unlikely to succeed. But what's interesting about the Overton window is the window is also defined by the margins. And so when in the States you get something like the Tea Party that shows up and pushes the extreme of the right side, and there's nothing to counterbalance it on the left, the whole window moves to the right. Like, because of the Tea Party, there's a lot of policies that have gone through that would never have been acceptable before. Back in the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr. was made more palatable by Malcolm X, because Malcolm X seemed so radical. It was like, oh, well, we can work with Martin Luther King because at least he's not that far. Yeah, there's a good book by Ward Churchill called Pacifism as Pathology, but he just kind of looks at this. Like in India, there were similar people who were much more radical than Gandhi, but they made Gandhi look okay, you know, like the government could deal with him. And if they hadn't been around, Gandhi and King would have been way too radical.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So you're doing marketing for hippies.
Yeah.
Do you feel like your business is having the impact that you hope it would? I mean, do you see that you're actually helping businesses not just survive but thrive, that then are also that they're the people creating this world change that you want to see?
Yeah, and it feels more on track every year. I feel like as I get clear in my work and clear about who I want to work with, I'm seeing more impact in the clients. I don't track it very well. This is part of the problem.
And I think you just posted something about tracking.
I know. Just expect me to do what I say.
Well, it takes time.
But yeah, I do feel hopeful about it. Yeah, you know, like one of my clients, Verge Permaculture, they came to me years ago trying to fill up their permaculture design certification. They were in this desperate crunch, and I was like, well, to fill up a big workshop like that, you'd want to do a lot of live intro workshops. And they're like, we don't have time. So he rewrote their sales letter. Because it was really just like all about the boat and not about the journey at all. We rewrote that. It helped. The next year, they did a tour. What I encouraged them to do is like find communities where there are people who could host you, like other permaculture groups, other conscious living groups who could host you for their people. Let them keep all the money on the workshop. They just pay you gas and do as many of these as you can. And they did. And they toured around and they filled their workshops. You know, I've been a marketing support for them over the years, and they've just built this incredibly thriving business as a permaculture, like probably one of the best permaculture businesses I've ever seen. So I played a small role in it, but it's like satisfying and exciting to see it.
And I saw that you are speaking Gaelic.
Yes.
So how is that going?
I started learning Gaelic in the early 2000s, and then I went to, did classes here in Edmonton, then I went to Nova Scotia 2004, 2005 to St. FX University, and then Scotland to the Gaelic College, Solomon Rostock, on the Isle of Skye for about 5 months. So that was 2006. So my Gaelic is probably getting a little more rusty, but one of the projects I've become involved in, if you go to Nova Scotia GaelsJam.com, the info is there, but it's creating an annual gathering for young leaders in the community to come together and just be with each other and learn about the work that each other are doing and support each other and just a real community building space. We've done it twice now, and it's been a huge hit. It's just like a 5-day event where there's a lot of singing songs and just sharing about what's going on in our lives, because often in the Gaelic scene, people get together at Kaylee's and events, but it's just a very social thing. There's not a lot of chance for depth. And so we do like a lot of just active listening exercises and ways for people to get to know each other in a deeper way than they might have a chance to just at events or as a part of projects. I feel like that's probably going to keep expanding.
How do you spend most of your day? What are maybe two tasks that you spend most of your time on?
Well, there's the appalling amount of time I spend on Facebook.
And is that business tasks?
Totally. Yeah, no, I'm not just looking up memes and sharing them, collecting them, putting them into carefully organized photo albums.
So you're interacting with...
Sure. These days, I've been creating a lot of info products that I've been meaning to create for years and years and years. So there's a lot of kind of writing and working on things, and when it's at a certain point, sending it to my assistant to look over it. Just endless, endless tinkering. That's kind of the phase that I've moved into. In the past, I was writing a lot of blog posts. That's how I'd spend a lot of my day. You know, I'd work on emails to my list. I'd work on blog posts and be leading workshops. Yeah, now these days, it's definitely shifted more towards actually creating products and monetizing some of the stuff. And so, yeah, this summer, we'll see a lot of that coming out. And then probably by next summer, I'll have the official Marketing for Hippies book, like a bookstore book, come out, which will just be stuff that I've already written on my blog, plus transcripts put together and then updated. So a lot of it's already kind of done, but just not nicely woven together. So I think that'll be a lot of my year. And then, you know, then I do improv comedy here in Edmonton. And
I bet that's fun. Is there something that's slowing you or your business down right now?
Oh, man. Well, it'd just be like having another assistant, probably.
Yeah.
I've loaded so much on my current assistant, who's great, who I really love, want to support. And like her being able to get back to me faster so that I can take the next step on things would for sure help.
Is your assistant virtual?
Yeah, she's actually an old Waldorf classmate of mine. And she's a mom, has some kids, has a little crafting business, and was just looking for some side work. And this showed up, and she's been the best to work with. So, yeah, she lives in Barrie, Ontario.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great opportunity we have today to be able to assist each other over long distances.
Oh, it's such a relief. Yeah.
Are there any, other than Facebook, are there any resources or tools that you use that we could learn about?
I use Twitter a little bit, though. For business, I don't rock Twitter very hard. Mostly Facebook. I mean, Constant Contact, you know, is an email provider. But Facebook is such a funny beast because, I mean, you can create your business page, but when you post something to it, it'll show what you post to maybe 5% of the people following you who've opted in to follow you. And then if they respond to it and interact with it, then it shows it to more people. But if very few people interact, then like nobody else gets to see it.
Yeah, unless you want to pay Facebook more money to talk to the people that followed you. Yeah.
Although I'll tell you one thing that Facebook pages are great for. We just did a contest called So You Think You Can Niche, and we invited people to submit a meme, like a photo, and then in 120 characters, their niche. And we created an album in the business page where all those photos went up so people could go check them out and look at other people's. We invited people then to go rate other people's from like 0 to 10 on how clear it was and to put any helpful comments that they wanted to put that might help that person make it more clear, and emailed my list about that, which drove people. So I must have added like 200 or 300 people to my Facebook page.
Wow.
So the infrastructure of those albums is perfect. Like couldn't be better. We had 126 submissions, 2,500 comments. So for that, it's great.
That's a great tip. I'm going to use that myself.
Yeah, it's super dope. There's actually a blog post recently on my blog. You can read about it.
Yeah, I'll check that out because I need to get the word out about Compassion Plan.
Yeah, so you could do a contest of like, what is compassion?
Yep, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, and it really does get people interacting. It's the trouble. To me, it's like the bottom line. The email list is still the core thing because that's where you have direct contact. They're probably not going to change the rules, except, I mean, of course, the CRTC in Canada just came out with this intense anti-spam legislation that is like a little over the top, which has totally decimated a bunch of email lists that I know of really good causes.
Yeah, I heard about that. I got a notice from one of my email providers. Or no, I'm sorry. I got the email from you.
Yeah,
there you go. Like, where did I get that from? Oh, yeah, from Ted. So that was really good to hear. Right now, it's just people I know, but I hope this to go worldwide and keeping up on different places in the world. And of course, Canada is going to be, you know, I hope to have a lot of great Canadians listening to it. So yeah, that was really helpful. The Compassion Plans audience really likes supporting the guests that come on the show because we want to change the world just like you do. What are two things we can do to help you?
So the first thing that comes up, the woman who runs the Nova Scotia Gales Jam is super incredible. She's a single mom. She does just a Herculean amount of work. And when we did the first Nova Scotia Gales Jam, it worked because she was the one hosting it. And that's why people